From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump has insisted that the U.S. is conducting more COVID-19 tests than most nations worldwide. He has also insisted that the numbers of infection in the U.S. are so high because the U.S. is doing so much testing, and that if testing were to slow down, so would infections. Testing is a critical part of the toolkit for bringing the pandemic under control, and the president's misinformation on the issue, or misunderstanding of it, has hampered efforts. The resulting patchwork approach to testing, state by state, has left some parts of the nation reeling with new infections. Many test sites are not even able to return test results in a timely manner. Meanwhile, Congress has appropriated billions more to fund testing in the latest COVID relief bill, but it is not clear how the funds will be used if the bill does pass into law. We turn now to Zoe McLaren. She's an associate professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. She just wrote an article for theconversation.com about the inadequacies of the U.S.'s COVID-19 testing and what needs to be done. Welcome to the program, Zoe.
Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about why testing is so important. I mean, certainly President Trump's claims have muddied the conversation and probably the understanding among the U.S. public of what the role of testing is. But basically, you want to be able to test widely in order to know the extent of a disease, but also in order to know where to control it if it's spreading, because you simply want to find out who's infected so they don't infect other people, right?
Exactly. The key to fighting a pandemic like this is to slow the spread of the virus. And to be able to do that, we need to know who's infected, where are the people that are infected, and testing is one of those things that helps us learn that. And if we don't test, that the transmission still happens. So the idea is that what matters not is just how many cases are tested, but how many cases are out there. And testing tells us how many cases are out there, but it also is an important tool that helps us slow the spread and reduce the number of cases. So I think about testing not just about learning information, but actually as part of a strategy for mitigating and suppressing and eventually eliminating the virus.
So I want to share with you and our audience my experience with testing. I'm in California, Southern California, and in late March, I fell sick. I got a cold, and it was right when everybody was worried about the pandemic. The state had shut down. I was terrified I had it, called my doctor through Kaiser and told her that I had a mild fever but no other symptoms, but I was definitely feeling sick. And her response was to say that my symptoms weren't strong enough to validate or to basically require that I get tested. I waited a few days, and then the LA County system started offering testing. So I contacted them. I had to, let's just say, exaggerate my symptoms because I felt that it was important for me to get tested because I am an essential worker. I've come in contact with at least one other person and have a family. So I got tested. Took 5 days to get the results. Mine came back inconclusive. My husband's came back negative. So we set up another test. Took 5 more days to get the results, and it was negative. But I really I'm not sure if I was, in fact, or my husband and I, we both got sick, if we really had it or not. To me, it seems as though my doctor's response saying, well, your symptoms aren't strong enough, is exactly the wrong kind of response. What do you think?
So when you think about wanting to get tested, putting yourself in the place of the person who wants a test, there are a lot of people out there who desperately want to know their status. They are sick and they want to know if it's COVID, or they're not sick, but they've been exposed and want to know if they've been infected. So that's kind of, there's a lot of demand for testing. The issue is looking at the supply of testing. And so doctors are often trying to manage this demand and the supply. Doctors want to make sure to serve their patients as well as possible and get people tests when they want them. But doctors are also aware of the fact that we have, back in March, and we continue to have major shortages of tests. And they know if the tests are used for people who are not very sick, they may not be available for people who are very high risk or who are very sick. So it's a matter of actually rationing the test availability.
Right. And that's a really important point because we aren't being told that this rationing is happening. That word isn't being used, and that's critically important. It seems to me that that was also the reason for the muddled message on masks. When the CDC first announced, made an announcement about mask wearing, they said that the public shouldn't go out and wear masks. But they didn't say it was because they were worried about the availability of N95 masks and wanted to make sure they were, you know, they were essentially rationing them for healthcare workers, which is certainly noteworthy. But what it ended up doing was cause confusion among the public about whether masks were even a useful tool to protect oneself. So we've basically had rationing of healthcare in the United States, which is just terrible because now we are here with the world's highest number of cases.
I think the story around testing and around PPE are very closely linked. These are two things that we needed in fairly large amounts before the pandemic, but during the pandemic, we needed much, much larger amounts. And we don't, and there are shortages, and it's not always clear that there are shortages. It's not, the messaging has not been particularly clear from the federal government about these shortages and how we adapt to the shortages. And so that's been a major issue around messaging, around both PPE and around testing. So for PPE, people have been using homemade masks and cloth masks. That was one way to adapt to the shortage. With testing, it's much harder to find potential substitutes for testing. There aren't kind of homemade tests that one can put together. So we really rely on the national availability of testing, not just test materials, but lab capacity, testing programs to reduce the amount of waiting and to make it easier, give everybody better access to testing. And that really does rely on some kind of response at both the state and the national level. But it's with testing in particular, the shortage is not something that can be easily rectified through market forces. It really requires forces outside the market, usually government forces, to come in and align incentives so that the country is able to ramp up testing to meet the need.
Right. We have such a tool. It's called the Defense Production Act. President Trump, unfortunately, has not invoked that when it comes to testing. He has invoked that to protect the meatpacking industry. But let's talk about one of the things you write in your article, which I think is really important for us to understand, is the lag time in getting a test and then getting your test result. 5 days is far too long. There are parts of the country now where it's taking up to 9 days to get your test results. And if you aren't quarantined for the entire time and it turns out you're infected, you could basically be passing the disease, the infection, to everybody around you. And that is exactly the wrong way to go about testing, right?
Exactly. The idea is that people who are unsure of their COVID-19 status should be quarantining between when they get a test and when they get the test result. We call that the turnaround time. And when the turnaround time is long and it's taking 7, 10, or in some cases 14 days for a test result to be returned, it means that individuals are either quarantining for that long when it turns out they were negative and not infectious anyway, or maybe they were only partially quarantining for that time and it turned out they were actually contagious and they ended up spreading it while they were waiting for their test result to get back. So when we think about the importance of testing, it's not just did someone actually get a test, are those test materials available, but was the test result returned to them and they had that information, they could take appropriate action, which means if they are contagious, if they have COVID-19, to isolate themselves to make sure they don't spread it to others, to connect them to contact tracers, an important service to help people who are contagious make sure that anyone else who may have been exposed to them is also connected with testing resources.
Right. Contact tracing is then that second tool in the toolkit that has to go hand in hand with adequate testing in order to bring the virus spread under control. One of the things I learned from reading your article was this idea of test positivity that epidemiologists use. This, I think, requires some clarity. I it would be so great to have our president understand what this means. But to explain to our audience what test positivity is and how it's a measure for whether, you know, a locality or city or state is adequately testing.
Of course. So this measure of test positivity is basically the percent of tests that come back as testing positive. And the WHO, the World Health Organization, has set this target of getting less than 5% test positivity as some kind of guideline that the epidemic is being controlled in that particular area. So the way that we want to think about test positivity is that we want to be testing a lot of people, even people that are negative, as a way to be sure that we're catching, ideally, all of the people who are contagious with COVID-19. And so the test positivity is that, so that 5% is saying that for every 20 tests that we do, only no more than one should come back positive. If we have higher rates, so some parts of the country have test positivity rates of 15% or up to 20%. And that's basically saying that too many of the tests we're doing are coming back positive. We're very likely to be missing even a lot of tests out there. So people that are not getting tested. So we see it as a measure of kind of how bad the epidemic is. But also I think about test positivity as a measure of how many cases are we missing. A high test positivity means that we're missing a lot of cases. And we can think about it in the extreme case. Imagine all of our tests are coming back positive. Well, that means we're catching a lot of positive cases, but we're probably also missing a lot of other positive cases that aren't even getting tested. And so that is a clear signal that we need to increase the amount of testing that we're doing. That doing tests to find that people are negative is not a waste. It's a way to be sure that we're catching all the positive tests.
Right. I mean, and it's a little counterintuitive. If your test positivity is low, that may actually mean you are doing adequate testing because the net that you're casting is capturing enough data points that the positive numbers among those are low compared to the whole. That means you're just, you know, you're casting a wide net and hopefully capturing more of the percentage of those who are infected. And it's, I hadn't really thought about it that way, but of course it makes sense because if you have pandemic response that simply involves people volunteering piecemeal, if they feel like it, if they feel sick, if they can get a test easy, if it's free, to sort of choose to go and take a test, you're probably just missing a lot of cases. And then you might have people where the doctors are trying to ration the test, so they're telling people even with symptoms that are mild not to get the test. But what we really need is what some countries have done successfully, which is widespread testing. Try to test everybody if possible, or as many people as possible in a systematic way. Tell me about what you write in your article in terms of the idea of being able to get home testing kits to all Americans every week, where they can just literally test themselves at home.
Yeah, so I like what you said about the test positivity being about casting a wide net. We want to be casting a wide enough net that we're catching so many negative tests that we're sure that we've caught most of the positive ones. And so ideally, when we think about what testing does, is testing provides us with information that the individual whose test it is can use, that the contact tracers can use, that communities can use, the national government can use. And so with information, we always want information to be free, to be as easy as possible to get, that it's real time so that you get information very fast, and that it's also highly accurate. And those are also the four things that we want for our testing program. And so if we think about the ideal situation, free, so you don't have to leave your house. You can do a test at home. You don't need to drive anywhere. You don't need to wait anywhere. The tests are delivered to you and there's no cost to you. Easy, the same thing at home. It takes 2 minutes. You can use a saliva sample instead of a nose swab or a blood sample. So the saliva is much easier and it's fast. So you get your results right away. You can do it before you leave the house in the morning, and that it's accurate. Ideally, these tests would be perfectly accurate. So that's the ideal situation. We don't necessarily need to get to that ideal situation to be able to suppress COVID-19 pandemic. But the idea is we think about that as the ideal, and that motivates us to move our testing program in any of those four dimensions to improve our testing program in those dimensions.
So in terms of the technical possibility, does such a test exist that is a test that can be mailed, that can be administered by the person taking it, and that can give you accurate enough results in minutes?
So no, not yet, but there are a number of different tests that are available. For example, there are rapid tests that take about 15 minutes. They can it's unlikely that someone would have that tool at home, but they could go to a central location. They could have it at workplaces. They could have it at schools. We don't have any test, as far as I know, that's perfectly accurate. But remember, we don't always need perfect accuracy. We can suppress the epidemic with less than perfect accuracy if we think about how to use the tests properly, appropriately, and also how to interpret the results. And there's an awful lot of innovation going on right now. So there are a number of different tests that are being developed right now. With additional funding, attention, they could potentially be brought to market. And then there's also some regulatory hurdles that would need to be broached as well. But when we think about testing, one phrase that comes up a lot is point of care. And that's kind of the idea that it doesn't have to go to a lab, that you have a machine that's portable that can be perform tests. And for example, that's what's being used at the White House right now. I believe they're using the Abbott test, which is a 15-minute rapid test, and is fairly accurate, but not perfectly accurate. But it can the right combination of these four criteria can produce something that helps us keep the epidemic under control, even if we're not in the ideal situation in terms of testing.
And it's just infuriating to hear that the president has ensured that the White House staff have access to this most accurate testing, while he just hasn't done enough to ensure that all Americans have access to this testing, and in fact has said the opposite, that he wants his people to slow down the testing because, of course, he knows it looks bad for the U.S. to have had so many documented cases of infection. Let's talk about the case of New Mexico, which you write about, which may perhaps come to the closest to the practical ideal scenario that we can have. What has New Mexico been doing in terms of testing its residents, and why has its approach been so successful?
So New Mexico has been doing very well in general on fighting the COVID pandemic within the state. And I think it's really, we could look to New Mexico for some lessons. So when we think about what New Mexico is doing, it comes back to these four criteria: that testing should be free, it should be easy, the test results should be delivered quickly, and they should be accurate. And they've done a really good job in terms of ensuring that the test is free and easy. So testing in a lot of places around the US is free. But what New Mexico did is they went an additional step beyond that and actually prohibited healthcare providers from charging for the test. So they basically made sure that no one would get a surprise medical bill, that people who didn't have insurance would still be guaranteed access to testing. They made it free, and that, of course, made it more accessible. In terms of making it easy, they encouraged everybody, regardless of symptoms, to get tested for COVID-19.
There you go. And that's critical.
Right. So, but it requires a certain level of resources because, of course, when there are shortages and you open testing really widely to anybody who wants it, you may end up having that people have very serious symptoms and need tests and aren't able to get access. So it's a kind of a tricky balancing act.
Right. But we're the world's richest country. We just, passed a Senate, the Senate just passed a $740 billion bill to fund the Pentagon. There's never an argument about whether we need a new fighter jet. But if we need tests, suddenly, lawmakers, unfortunately, bring up questions of resources that are available. We are the world's richest nation. We should be able to set aside the resources so that everybody, including those without symptoms, have access to testing without fear of test shortages.
Exactly. So the resources are they exist, but two things need to happen. One is that people need to decide that testing is a priority, and that's where they want to put the resources. And second, when people decide that, if they're the voters, they need to make sure that people who hold control over the purse strings hear those concerns about prioritization and make sure the money shows up. The money just doesn't automatically flow to testing programs because you or I think that they're really important and that's where the money should be. And so we need to think about it more about, it's not just about do we have money in the coffers, but is it being allocated to the right purposes? And I will say that there was, I think, $25 billion allocated to PPE and testing in a bill that passed in April. And a few senators released a letter a few days ago that said over half of that money had not been spent, according to the Department of Health and Human Services.
Oh, unbelievable.
And so part of that is the money has been allocated specifically to PPE and testing, but then there wasn't necessarily enough enough follow-up to make sure that money was actually spent on these priorities that it had been allocated to. And so I think the idea that we just say, oh, we think testing is important, there's money, it should go there, it's not sufficient to make sure the money actually gets to the programs and to make sure it's allocated to the programs, it's spent on the types of things that matter to individuals, which are, do they have access to testing? Is it free? Is it easy? Do they get their test results quickly? And are the test results accurate?
Do you have any sense of why that money wasn't spent? I mean, is the U.S. struggling with lab capacity? We know that in Europe, for example, Germany has had a very successful, manner of, relatively speaking, controlling the virus. And that had to do with the country very early on seeing what was unfolding in China and Italy, marshalling the resources of all the labs, the private labs and the publicly funded ones in the country to ensure that they could be capable of handling the testing needs of the nation. Is our testing infrastructure and lab infrastructure just inadequate?
In terms of lab capacity, we are definitely maxing out lab capacity in the private sector. It appears that there is actually excess capacity, so additional free capacity in some state labs, potentially university labs, some hospital labs, possibly in certain parts of the country. And so it's not just a matter of, oh, we can't spend the funding because our lab capacity is maxed out. The idea about the funding and the kind of broadest way to think about it is that we can use the funding to grease the wheels of the testing program. So the idea is if we need to hire more staff, the funding can do that. So it may not be about lab capacity, it may be about delivery, it may be some other bottlenecks. And there are certain things, there are other types of, so we can spend some of that money to support and drive innovation of new tests. However, if there are additional regulatory barriers, then it's possible that we can't actually spend that money as effectively. But part of it is just that we need to follow up. When there's money that's spent and allocated, there needs to be some follow-up to figure out kind of where that money went, what it was spent on, and if it wasn't spent, to ask why, because there's lots of ways that additional funding can be used to support the testing programs. And if it's unclear what that is, well, we can hire some people to figure out kind of what the solution is, how to spend the money. But the resources are available, and there's a lot of different things. There's a lot of room for innovation in building testing programs. And it's just, I think there's been a lot more focus on testing in the last 2 or 3 weeks, especially with the turnaround time. It's made a lot of people very frustrated. And so there's been a lot of discussion about it. And I think in a lot of ways, that's a good thing because people are kind of waking up that we need to focus on testing a lot more to be able to fight this pandemic.
Right. And then once testing is under control, contact tracing. But of course, unfortunately, we live in a country where political ideology seems to be getting in the way of public health. There are certain, members of society, certain people in power who are so worried about federal government mandates or just the federal government just taking charge and showing leadership. So let me ask you finally, then, shouldn't testing also not be a state by state or a city by city approach? It really ought to be. There really ought to be a uniform federal approach and federal oversight of testing so that things are conducted in an organized, methodical fashion to bring this under control.
I think that a number of the issues around public health have been politicized, but it's important to remember that the vast majority of the country, for example, wears masks and thinks that they're very important.
Right. A new poll shows 75% of Americans now support mask mandates, not just wearing of masks, but the mandating of wearing masks.
Exactly. And I think the testing program is a really good example of where it's not politicized. Everybody out there wants to know what their COVID-19 status is. They want to know if they're positive to make sure they don't infect their family and their friends. They want to know if they're negative so they have some peace of mind. So it's something, regardless of political ideology, that people want access to. And so it's not something that's being forced on people. It's something that people really demand and really value. And that's something that the government really should be providing for its citizens. And yes, it's possible for every individual organization to scale up their own testing program. We've seen that certain workspaces are doing their own testing. Professional sports are doing their own testing design and programs. A number of universities are planning on doing their own testing programs.
But they have the money to do them, right? What you've just pointed out are all institutions that have the money and are willing to spend it on the people that they deem important or necessary. I mean, who's testing our grocery store workers or delivery drivers and the other essential workers that are low-wage workers?
And we think about bringing schools back in the fall. So K-12 schools do not have the resources to start up their own testing programs. Right. And so that's one way where states can build their strong testing programs to support schools. And it would be great if we could build really strong testing programs on a state-by-state basis without federal intervention. But my understanding is that it's not that it's not possible, it's just very inefficient and ineffective. Mm-hmm. That the amount of time and energy we would put into building our own individual state program would likely be more effectively spent working together with other states to make sure that the federal government is doing the types of things it could be doing to improve the market. There are problems in the supply chain, and those are the types of problems that are not easily solved on a state-by-state basis, much easier solved at the national level. And there's also a lot of uncertainty, which I think is kind of an undercurrent through all of this, is that individual lab companies and states and individual people as well would be making very different choices if they knew what the future looked like. But it's very hard for lab companies, for example, to think about changing their business model or expanding lab capacity or switching from one type of test to another type of test when they're unsure what the funding will be in the future, what the demand for testing will be in the future, because eventually we should have a vaccine and we'll have a much lower demand for testing. And that uncertainty makes everyone very hesitant about taking the type of actions that we need to take. And that is actually a very important role for the federal government, is to create some kind of certainty, some kind of guidelines and support and funding that help people make optimal decisions in terms of building testing programs. And when I say testing programs, I want to make it very clear that I mean it's not just performing the tests, it's the lab capacity, getting the test results, getting them back in a reasonable amount of time that allows for contact tracing, which is a really, really important part of the whole testing apparatus as well.
Well, I want to thank you, Zoe, so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our website. Good luck to you.
Thanks, Anali. It was a pleasure.
My guest has been Zoe McLaren, Associate Professor of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. Her article can be found at theconversation.com. We've been talking about the inadequacies of the U.S.'s current COVID-19 testing. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.